Welcome to Theatre Voice, the V&A's archive of conversations with leading theatre practitioners. I'm Tim Bano, I'm the editor of Theatre Voice, which is a huge collection of interviews with many of the most extraordinary people in theatre. This episode marks our now annual post-Edinburgh Fringe catch-up with two trusted critics. So I'm delighted to welcome back Arifa Akbar, critic for The Guardian, and Fergus Morgan, critic for The Scotsman and The Stage, among other places, to talk us through this year's Fringe. What was good? What was bad? Fergus, why don't we start with you? Can you take us through the Fringe in some of the numbers? How were ticket sales this year? It felt like a busy city, but is that actually reflected in the numbers?
I think it probably has felt like a busy city for the last 20 years to say, just from walking around. I think it felt particularly busy this year over the middle weekend because Oasis arrived in Edinburgh for three gigs at Murrayfield, which sold 60,000 tickets each, at the same time as the Fringe, at the same time as the Military Tattoo was going on, at the same time as some giant wedding happened on George Street that me and you, Tim, had the misfortune of seeing the kind of drunken aftermath of, the kind of men brawling on the street. So the city felt very crowded. Interestingly, there was a lot of concern that the Oasis gigs would take audiences away from the festival and that Storm Florence closed some venues on the first Monday, which meant that some performances there were lost. And I think that has had an effect on ticket sales, which are at 2.6 million tickets, which sounds like an incredible amount, but it is the same amount as last year. And since COVID, there has been a general trend of performances of ticket sales increasing year on year. And this is the first year that they have not increased year on year. Very slightly down.
And what's on stage say that the figure from last year, it was fractionally down from last year. It was 2.61 last year. Slightly less coming this
year.
It
is interesting. And interestingly, there were the most shows ever this year, or most events in the Fringe program. So substantially more than last year. So what that means broadly is very slightly fewer audiences, but spread over a larger amount of shows. So fewer audiences per show, effectively. You can dive a bit deeper into those numbers and work out kind of the length of runs and the size of venues and things like that. But the headline is smaller audiences for shows.
It's interesting because it felt like an Edinburgh that had a number of these kind of key moments during it, didn't it? Like, as you say, pretty much a couple of days after everyone arrived was this big storm, and it felt quite apocalyptic in Edinburgh. You know, there were kind of bits of venue just flying across the city because a lot of venues are temporary structures and they're tents and that kind of stuff. And then you had a run of really nice hot weather. Then you had Oasis coming across three separate nights, across the kind of first big weekend of the festival. Then at the end of the festival, you even had AC/DC playing at Murrayfield. So like there were these big kind of moments throughout the thing, which made it feel like a slightly unusual festival this year. I mean, Arifa, just in general impressions, how did you find it compared to previous years?
I know that there was the usual hullabaloo, but I did find it quieter. I think, yeah, slightly muted. Maybe I was imagining it. But what I did see this year was that there were a series of really high-profile shows that were quite polished. And ordinarily, I wouldn't think of them, I'm not even sure they qualify as fringe shows in the raw and most authentic sense of the word. So I'm talking about shows like Ohio, which was much fated, you know, very highly anticipated. It's a meditation on sort of faith, loss by a duo.
And I think already had a London run booked.
Had a London run booked. It's due to come to the Young Vic imminently in September. There was Hot Mess by a brilliant duo that proved themselves, Jack Godfrey and Ellie Coote, which I loved. But just to say, that had had a run already at Birmingham. So it had its dry run in Birmingham. And there were other shows. And I know it was part of the international offering, which is also always more polished, was James Graham's play Make It Happen. But even within the fringe realm, I felt that the sets were more polished. The actual show had a bit more money behind it. And I felt as if those shows were great often, but were they cheating? Because there's something about the fringe that seems to be going slightly more polished than the original. You know, you find six students from Footlights, you know, Oxford or wherever and a donkey coming and setting up and having no sets whatsoever, and just this sort of raw talent idea. I still think that's happening, but I think it's not happening as much because of the prohibitive rents. And what I saw was this sort of more polished level of show. I loved Hot Mess a lot, but it was nothing. It wasn't that student show that had just, you know, had 100% sense of discovery, because it always already had these this former life and then shows with next life, future life.
So it's interesting you say that, and it's interesting that both those examples are musicals, because I would say, just to put the kind of opposite view there, that actually there were, when you talk about plays, there were a huge number of shows which I felt were a bit underdeveloped. And I wonder whether when you're talking about a musical, if it's on stage at the Edinburgh Fringe, it's already had to go through quite a process. And I think you're absolutely right. Often that's now backed by a venue or a producer like Francesca Mudi, or, you know, a venue like Birmingham Rep, which has a whole kind of seedbed department for new musicals. And they're so expensive to put on. They need so much more in terms of, you know, pre-recording, rehearsing, maybe live musicians, that kind of stuff, that often when they get to Edinburgh, they are at a kind of polished stage. When it comes to plays, I wonder whether you are actually then getting a kind of polar effect, which is that people don't have the resources to polish their writing and their performances as much as they might want to before you get to the Fringe. And I saw quite a lot of work that I had strong dramaturgical notes on and think needed another couple of passes before it was ready to be in front of paying audiences. What do you think about that, Fergus?
I think back in the day, it used to be the case that you had the International Festival and then the Fringe, which was a kind of free-for-all of students, amateurs, wannabes, doing whatever they wanted, and some of it was amazing and some of it was shit. Increasingly, I think there are kind of stratas within the Fringe. There's the International Festival, which is all extremely well-funded, massive institutional support, massive amounts of resource to put behind shows. Now you have the big shows at the Fringe, like the ones Aretha's mentioned, like maybe some of the ones at the Traverse as well, like Tom at the Farm that the Pleasants put on, which are, by and large, like professionally produced theatre shows that could be pop up in any theatre around the UK, any kind of mid-scale theatre in the UK. And then beneath that, there's another strata, which is slightly less well-funded. And then there's that all of that is still the tip of the iceberg. And then beneath that, you've got this kind of morass of stuff that doesn't have a lot of money, doesn't have a lot of publicity support. And we just don't see anymore, because there's only so many hours in the day. There's only so many of us, and we just can't get around it. So all of our time is basically taken up seeing these professional shows now. So that's the kind of perception of it that we get, I would say.
In some ways, I'm agreeing with the opposite, with what both of you have just said. It's just I haven't, and maybe this is my naivety, or maybe I'm generalizing, but I haven't seen plays that have come with previous life and have been tried and tested. Consumed is another one. That's not a musical, that's a play. I think it had, it's had a very long gestation period. I think it's on a tour. I think it's going to other places. I'm pretty sure it's going to other UK venues. These are, and maybe as you say, Fergus, you know, the Traverse, certainly the International Festival, those plays aren't by no means, you know, to be discovered. They have been discovered. They're exciting plays from around the world in Europe that the international plays programmed. But the Traverse, definitely really quite polished, you know, such as Consumed.
Well, as you'd expect, I suppose, from an organization that gets that amount of money. It speaks to something Lynn Gardner wrote about in the stage. It's like, what is the Fringe four at the moment? Ohio already had a run at Bristol Old Vic and the Young Vic lined up, I think. The Hot Mess clearly like was going to go elsewhere if it didn't have it lined up already.
I think it's already have it lined
Playhouse
up.
Yeah. Already had it lined up to the Southwark Playhouse. Consumed already had a tour lined up. What are these shows at the festival for? They must assume they wouldn't do it if they didn't work commercially successful to an extent at the Fringe, because they don't need the exposure of the festival. They don't need the platform of the festival anymore.
I wonder if they're trying out audiences. This is what one of the cynic in me thought. Are these kind of quite moneyed or high profile shows just trying out a sort of almost a developmental phase, thinking, is this going to work in front of an audience, and what's the risk, and sort of getting a first bite on appraisal, and is that what the festival's for? I'm not quite sure. Maybe they've always existed, but I'm much more growing more conscious of what the producers are trying to do. They're the canny element of what they're trying to do. And I love the idea of, you know, genuine discovery, that somebody might not have money enough for a cool set, like many of these shows, or big stars. You know, Hot Mess had an astonishing singer in Daniel Steers, who was one of the queens in Six, the musical, obviously, which also originated at the Fringe. But, you know, my idea of, like, the Fringe is something in its rawness that you see and you think, you know, there's this total sense of discovery and unknown names and maybe, you know, an unknown producer attached to it. But that's the romance of the festival.
But then I feel a sense of guilt, you know, because I think you both touched on this. We do have very limited time. I mean, this struck me when Natasha Chipney, you know, friend and colleague of ours who was writing for The Stage this year, she, in her Substack, she wrote, I saw 52 shows this year. And it's weird because that is both a huge number and a tiny number. And when I read that, I was like, oh, that's not many at all, considering there are 3,800 shows at the Fringe. But it's also 52 shows over the course of 2.5 weeks is a stupid amount of shows. And it's that impossible thing. And I wonder whether critics have limited time and the stuff that gets filtered up to us is the stuff that's got the PR, it's got the word of mouth, it's the stuff that's got the backing. And I'm sure there are hundreds and hundreds of shows that are there waiting to be discovered. And I personally don't quite know how to discover them. I feel like I've lost maybe my discovery instincts a bit.
But what are we to do? We're three humble, you know, arts journalists with only so many hours in the day and only
and
getting paid so much.
We don't want to see rubbish either. You know, yeah, we don't want to waste our time with rubbish.
Absolutely. But what I think we should, the only thing that I can do as a critic is emphatically not follow other critics. Yeah, we are to some ways being dictated to, just through sheer volume, to buy the most effective PRs. But I do think it's within our, we have a responsibility to think about, okay, what showcases are coming from various countries? What are the big shows that I feel that I can't miss as a critic? Such as Consume, such as Hot Mess and the rest of it. But what are the shows that are, you know, I'm flicking through this great big pamphlet that they give you that just appeal to me as a punter? What might I go and book if I were not a critic? And what appeals to my interests? So, and they might be tiny shows and hopefully obscure shows that no other critic will think they have to cover. So I do a bit of all of those. Oh, I try to.
You're a better critic than me, Arifa. I go to the stuff I get sent to. And then I get terrible fringe FOMO where everyone says, oh, Hot Mess is amazing. Hot Mess is amazing. Instead of spending an hour going to see something else that hasn't got any critical coverage, I'm like, well, I'm going to go get a ticket to Hot Mess because everybody says it's great.
Exactly. And you do want to, you want to be the, you know, a critic that has seen the hot thing, because even if 6 or 7 critics in Edinburgh have seen it, you're still ahead of the curve of the people who aren't in Edinburgh, who haven't seen it. And when it's going to come to London later in the year, you can be like, well, I saw it in Edinburgh. You know, it is still quite a valuable thing, but that's an hour
of course.
Out.
And I live in Edinburgh, so I don't get to see the stuff.
Yeah, exactly. You don't get to see it at Southwark Playhouse, but that is the tricky thing. And, you know, you don't want to sit there for hour after hour, day after day, seeing stuff that turns out not to be worth your time. And that is the risk of taking a punt. But I also think that's quite, it differs slightly for the three of us and for all the critics, because it depends on what publication you're writing for. And I guess The Guardian, you've got quite a broad slate of what The Guardian might be interested in covering.
Well, we've also got, thank God, we've got a big team. We've got several people up there. So I have the luxury of not getting FOMO, because if I've missed in my 8 days there, if I've missed the big thing that people are talking about, there are others there to cut. There's numerous critics for The Guardian covering it simultaneously. I'm never working on my own. That's the luxury you have, my publication has. And The Guardian still takes this fringe really seriously. It doesn't just send its chief critic up for 2 weeks and then thinks, well, we've done the first 2 weeks or last 2 weeks, that's it.
Yeah.
We're doing it to the end. And there's about 3 or 4, I think, maybe more of us doing stuff.
And then to contrast that with...
Can I ask a question about... Because I'm good friends with Mark Fisher up here at Arifa, and he was telling me how... His 5 stars for Eat the Rich, basically, although it was a great show, it transformed the fortunes of the show, because The Guardian review,
yeah.
is the five-star Guardian review is what everybody wants. And I wonder whether the pressure or the weight of responsibility, given that reviews has such greater currency at the Fringe than they probably do in any other context, weighs heavily upon you when you're roaming the streets of Edinburgh.
I think it does weigh heavily upon you, but also the measure by which you allocate your stars becomes different. It's not so much, oh, I want to direct people to this show because, you know, it'll make money and sell tickets and it's the best thing I've seen so far, so it deserves five. It's that the measure is slightly different because these are shows in the rough. You know, they're rough hewn, they're rough diamonds. So if you see, you know, a spark of brilliance, I would give it five, where alongside its flaws. Whereas in London or in a, you know, in an environment where those shows have had proper development and funds, no, they wouldn't be five-star shows. But in a way, they deserve to be five-star shows because there's something really brilliant and alive and invigorating. So I personally, I have been up years where there's been, I don't think there's been any five stars. When was that? It might have been last year, or maybe I gave one to an international festival show. But I'm perfectly willing to, for myself, willing to go to a festival and not give any five stars out.
Can I ask how many five stars you each gave this year?
I gave two.
Which were the shows?
Hot Mess, because I absolutely adored it and came out wanting to see it again.
So just to explain, that was a two-hander musical about the relationship between Earth and humanity. So Earth and humanity are played by two different characters. And then what was the other one, Aretha?
The other one was The Horse of Janine, which is almost like a stand-up gig, you know, comedy. But it's about the West Bank and occupation in the West Bank. Now, you know, that was part of a whole load of Gaza shows and very political protest shows. But this one was so great because it was sort of funny and very life-affirming. And you went in thinking, oh, God, Israel, occupation in Gaza. This is going to be heavy. This is going to be full-on. And actually, one of the first jokes by the actor was, my name is Allah, not Allah, you know, and it was kind of quite risk-taking and fun, and it was about boyhood during occupation. So I found that really invigorating and quite surprising too.
So I'm going to ask you a follow-up question to those five-star shows in a sec, but Fergus, tell me, what were the fives you gave?
I think I gave out four.
Four?
One was,
wow.
One was for Lost Lear at the Travis, which I adored.
Tell us a bit about that.
It's a play by Darren Colley, which focuses on an elderly Irish actress living with dementia. She's called Joy, and she is in a kind of experimental care facility where her delusions, instead of being kind of confronted with reality and denied, they're indulged. So her carers spin and swirl around her, playing the characters in King Lear to her Lear. And it's a real treatment for dementia. And obviously it layers the scenes of senility and the themes of senility in King Lear over into the modern world in a really beautiful way, so that her lines mean two things at the same time. And the drama of it, the jeopardy of it, comes from her son, who has been somewhat abandoned by her and who cannot find a way into her world of make-believe on his own terms, so has to play Cordelia to her Lear. And it works really, really beautifully. I find it so moving.
It's very moving and very, very theatrical. And what were the other three, without giving such long-winded answers?
Sorry. Well, that one takes a lot of explaining, to be fair. The other three were Windblown, which is Kareem Polwart's story of a sable palm tree in the Edinburgh Glasshouse, which was cut down in 2021. And it's just a beautiful story about a tree told to really moving song. Other one was Philosophy of the World, the In Bed With My Brother show about the Shags, the band that were famously derided in the 1970s as being one of the worst bands of all time.
I think this is one of the 70s. Shows that made almost every What I'm Looking Forward To at the Fringe This Year list. Yeah,
and it was great.
Well,
and
we had different views.
Oh, yeah.
I liked it, but didn't really.
And they kind of tear the set apart while they're doing it. It's very anarchic and fun. And then the last one, which I saw in like the last weekend, was Gary Starr, Classic Penguins, which is one of the funniest things I have ever seen in the theatre. And a real rebuttal to those that say that, you know, you can't be, that woke has killed comedy, which is just not true at all. You
can
break incredible boundaries and do it with such care and consideration at the same time.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Can I say one thing? This is a non-star rated show because I knew the person, but I have to say this was one of my highlights because I knew the writer, and it was a play called Sky, and it's a ghost story by Ellie Keel. Now, Ellie Keel is a theatre producer, and I know her and I like her. I like her work. I like how she, she co-founded the Women's Prize for playwriting. So she's a good egg, but also produces great shows. Now, this was her debut. I didn't want to review it because I felt I knew her too well. But you know how when you know somebody who's either written a book or written something and you go there dutifully and think, oh, God, I'm going to have to carefully construct my response because I want to be a good person, a good friend, and say the right things. And I saw this show and I was really staggered by how good it was. I love a ghost story, but I know very often ghost stories on stage as on the page can go wrong because they can be cliche filled, or you can see the jumps coming, or they just don't make you jump, or they have bad endings because they're very famous. It's very hard to give a ghost story a good ending. And this just was beautifully acted, beautifully constructed, really original. It was about siblinghood. It was about siblings and loss, grief, and what grief can do. And, the delusional stuff that grief does to you. Anyone who's experienced grief will know. And I felt it was fabulous. I would have, I would have given it high four, very high four, incredibly strong play. I was stunned by the beauty, it was written beautifully. So I had this, I was on a high when I then said to Ellie afterwards, I loved your play and meant it.
So, I'll briefly take you through the fives that I gave, which I think I gave two, and one of them was Windblown, Like You, Fergus, which I thought was very, very beautiful, very moving. Kareen Polwart is a fantastic writer and performer and storyteller. And the other one was an international festival show called Works and Days, which was by a Belgian theatre collective. And it was just so visually stunning. And I was sitting next to you, Aretha, wasn't I, for that?
I'm with you, or three quarters of the way. I'm absolutely with you on how blown away I was.
And there was some discussion between us about whether a real chicken got killed on stage or not. It didn't. But it was very
convincing. The pineapples, sir.
Exploding pineapples at the end. I mean, just to give you a flavour of what the show was like, it starts with an actor taking an axe to the stage and axing the splinter, the stage is splintering, and then getting a plough, like a real life plough, and then ploughing the boards of the stage. It's a really extraordinary piece about kind of, relationship between humanity and the earth over the centuries. So those are my two fives. But the follow-up question I wanted to have was, those were our fives, but were there shows that have actually kind of lingered in your memory that weren't necessarily the ones that you in the moment gave those five stars to?
There was a play called Red Like Fruit. I don't know if either of you saw it.
Yeah,
we
saw it next to each other, didn't we, Fergus?
Yeah, we saw it next to... we both liked it, and then we went out and we spoke to Kirsty Walkoff of the BBC, who didn't, and then we both were like, yeah, it wasn't that good after all, was it?
And then we carried on talking about it for another hour, I think. I actually, that is the play that I think gave us the most interesting discussion, Fergus, me and you.
In my head, it was about Me Too. It's a post-Me Too play about a journalist, a female journalist, who's sort of seems to be having her eyes opened around sexual assault, sexual abuse, somebody else's case that she's investigating, which leads her back to herself, remembering, moments of assault, really, that she had somehow, repressed, and it's coming out now. And what she does, the big surprise of the play, of the big gimmick, I would say, of the play, is that her story is being told by a man. She has elected this man to tell her story, and because, and this is supposed to be the big surprise, I'm afraid, spoiler alert, people believe these stories when men tell them. People believe men rather than women. Women are not believed in courts as in life.
And the thing that I think we both found really extraordinary about it was the way that she's constantly questioning the sexual encounters she's had and whether they were consensual or not, and really getting into the kind of the details of them and the questioning that comes with them, and the level of comfort or safety she felt in each of them. And some of them are just unquestioningly
right. So that's awful. But for me, it there was a naivety there that just did not suit, that did not align with the voice of this experienced journalist who is questioning what around assault cases and questions of consent that as a society we have well and truly addressed. So who is this naive person that the voice just doesn't make sense to me?
Such a brilliant concept, but I think that just it wasn't quite the kind of the content of it, the narrative almost didn't quite work with the concept. There needed to be more of a gray area in her head, whereas it was clearly sexual assault.
I could find a kind of justification for that from the player. You know, I would be able to argue that it was a deliberate thing, that we're meant to think that this experienced journalist is being too naive in the way she's retelling the story, or that there is a kind of extra layer there, which is that maybe the man who's telling her story, this actor who's reading out her story, is sort of meant to think like we're thinking, like, obviously this is assault, you know, and that kind of adds a layer of incredulity to him reading it out. I mean, there are kind of justifications for it, but I don't know whether I sort of fully subscribe to those justifications or whether it was just a flaw of the writing. I don't quite
know. It was a really lovely, subtle piece of writing as well. There was so much kind of violence imbued with throughout the story, the way that even in the kind of consensual romantic relationship, she was kind of shoved up against a wall at one point when someone kisses her. There was she went for dinner with a kind of colleague of hers, and there was kind of violence in the way that he was talking at her the whole
just
time.
A small
and it was very, very subtle. So it's slightly dissonant to have such a kind of unsubtle divide kind of central bit within the rest of all that subtlety.
If I kept puzzling over, and the next day and the next day, and it stayed in my head as a puzzle. I loved some of the storytelling and the performances. I'll say this, the third layer was internalized misogyny. This was a big thing for me. So I thought at first, oh, this is really clever, because the playwright has created a woman who is so unknowing of her own internalized misogyny. The first thing she says is she goes to this therapy self-help, you know, circle of women. And she said, I felt like a real failure, all these fat women around me. And she was this kind of vile, the kind of woman that I think is, you know, home county is annoying, even though she was American, you know, soccer mom, basically, but a journalist too. And then she carries on and she's investigating a story for a newspaper around a woman being assaulted by her then boyfriend. She phones up the boss who re-employed the boyfriend, and in a matter of minutes, you know, she's seduced by this boss's explanation of how she's seduced by this boss. She wants to please him. She wants him to like her. And again, is that internalized, you know, that felt like an internalized misogyny. That felt like that woman, that soccer mom, would want a man's would want to please.
Which is that she's Canadian, not American.
Sorry, she's Canadian, not American. Yeah, too right. The other, the playwright's Canadian, isn't she? But then later on, I was thinking, hang on a minute, is this just the internalized misogyny of the playwright? Is this the playwright writing in internalized misogyny, or is she just thinking this way? So that really bothered me. That bothered me that she thinks this is just your average kind of Canadian woman who isn't misogynistic. And that bothered me the most, that the playwright had just thought that this woman was your average woman.
Whereas, and then that's quite an interesting thing, because as a critic, that is the classic debate, isn't it? Do you assume the best of the writer? Do you assume that it's deliberate and intentional, or do you assume that it was...
I did interview her.
Yeah.
I did interview her, and I thought she was very, very sharp and switched on. So I don't believe there was anything in that play that wasn't at all intention.
Well, the other reason why I think responded to it more positively than others, than Yuri, for and than Kirsty, was that I didn't know that it wasn't real. I thought it was a memoir play about the, you know, I thought this character was real, and that it, the woman sitting on stage, even if she was an actor, was sort of portraying someone. So, you know, that
you
kind of...
do your research, Tim.
Well, I do. I tend to do it after the play, though. Yeah. So that's good. But I was much more well disposed towards it because I thought it was her genuine experience, and that those were the things she really felt in those moments. So I think that adds another kind of layer of interesting stuff to it. But
the thing that really rankled, and again, it sends me back to, was the character internalizing misogyny, or was the playwright somehow making these slightly anti-female assumptions was the gimmick around the man having to tell the story. I mean, for heaven's sake, that was such a clunky. It really made me quite cross that this woman would cede her power of telling her own story to a man, to a man's voice, because you all believe men more than you believe me, so I'm not going
I didn't buy that. I didn't buy the explanation that came at the end, and I thought that that was a bad way of explaining it away. It didn't work for me. But what I wonder whether me and Fergus being men, it did actually work for us in a way, just the act of it, because you do start to see the latent violence in so much of the encounters that this woman had. You know, the man talking about, having a man talk through as a woman's voice talking about the way that she experiences a man talking to her, you're like, God, I can see how.
God, we're dicks.
Yeah, exactly. How awful it is. Yeah, it did feel like a play, maybe, that was written or sort of felt like the vibe of 2017, 2018, doesn't it? And there was a kind of pre-Me Too naivety to it.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Red Light Fruit was on at the Travis. I think it'd be interesting to talk about the Travis this year and maybe broaden that into a bit of a wider discussion, because there was very little new work at the Travis. The Travis has always prided itself on being a new writing theatre, you know, Scotland's new writing theatre. There wasn't actually much new work at the Travis. Like, it was a lot of imported work. Why, Fergus, you've probably got the inside track here. Do you know why that is? Do you think that's a fair assessment?
Yes, that is a fair assessment. There wasn't very much new work at the festival, and there hasn't been very much new work on its stages for the last couple of years. I know Linda, the executive director, and Gareth, the artistic director, and they would say that the theatre is going through a period of transition where it moves from one business model to another, and that they have big plans, and that there was a little bit of a hiccup in January when Creative Scotland revealed its last kind of round of multi-year funding, and the Travis was not included in the three-year list. It was only given funding for 1 year. They will say that that is just to see it through through this transitional period, and that it will receive long-term funding after that and will be back to kind of firing on all cylinders. But questions remain. You do worry, because it is our kind of Scotland's flagship theatre, and you know, during August, at the kind of busiest time for theatre in Edinburgh, for theatre in Scotland, you want it to be kind of front and centre and showcasing Scottish new writing from around Britain and around the world. And it didn't quite feel like it was at the centre of that conversation this year, albeit there being some really terrific shows there.
There were some great shows,
but there were also, you know, shows that had been here, had already premiered elsewhere, shows that had been on 10 years ago and they just brought back. It didn't feel particularly invigorating beyond the kind of individual shows that we've already mentioned. One great one was Nowhere, by the way, the Khalid Abdallah show, which I thought was really terrific, kind of sprawling, but very, very moving.
I'd seen it in London.
Yeah. But yeah, likewise, that had come from Battersea Arts Centre. That was an existing piece of work.
What about the kind of the themes of shows in general? You know, were there anything that cropped up? I mean, Fergus and I had lots of chats about this. We were sort of, I don't know, Fergus, you can kind of expand on this a bit, but I think we felt that there was a lot of absurdist humour. There was a lot of clowning humour. There was a lot, you know, we've slightly moved past the stage of, you know, for want of a better term, kind of trauma monologues. So people writing monologues about particular problems that they have. There are still a lot of those, but it seems like the really exciting shows were moving beyond that and trying to find new forms. There were groups like, you mentioned Philosophy of the World earlier, Fergus, the group who made that In Bed With My Brother. They're a kind of anarchic theatre group. There were a duo called Creepy Boys, whose show Slugs I really loved, which was they tried to make a, as they claim, a show about nothing, and all these big themes kept cropping in because there's so much awful stuff going on in the world. But it felt like kind of younger artists trying to grapple with so much stuff going on in the world and not quite knowing how to do it, and reaching this kind of point where language isn't adequate anymore, and maybe only absurdism or nihilism or chaos is gonna be enough.
I think absurdism, I definitely saw that. I saw that in it, and kind of almost mime and using song rather than, you know, spoken stuff. So I saw some of that. I saw politics, you know, there's world politics, and Gaza raised its head. Climate was another thing that I saw in many. Climate and illness, but the politics of illness too. I don't know if you saw any illness plays. I felt I was seeing quite a lot. I mean, you mentioned the dementia play, Fergus.
Lost Lear.
I saw I'm Ready to Talk Now at the Traverse as well, which was a one-to-one drama about illness and within that trans identity. But it was about kind of chronic illness and someone's immune, you know, autoimmune condition. But it wasn't just here's my trauma, here's my experience. It sort of had bigger ripple effect. It had a bigger ripple kind of effect, and it was more politicized. So when it was personal, I think it was kind of tethered to something bigger than just their personal experience, which I quite like. The stories are becoming maybe a bit bigger again.
Bit bigger, a bit weirder, I think. And I think you can see that in comedy as well. There were those shows you just mentioned, Tim, but then within the comedy world, there's Joe Kent Waters pretending to be Frankie Monroe, you know, the landlord of a working men's pub that's also a portal to hell. There's Julia Masley, the Estonian clown, kind of creeping around the stage and solving people's problems with this absurd voice. There's Gary Starr, a guy pretending to be kind of dressed up like a penguin and just getting the audience through insane things on stage. It does feel, me and you, Tim, agreed that we were, I think I said it and you stole it, we were post something. We weren't sure what we were post, but we were definitely post something.
Unclear whether, because I feel like I said it and you might have stolen it and put it in your successful Substack. It's unclear, Fergus. We'll both claim credit. Post something, sexy chaos clowns was another term that came up. There was a lot going on this year. But it was fun, though. It was fun. I want to talk really briefly before we finish about the International Festival. My feeling about the International Festival this year is that there was a kind of fearlessness in the theatre programme that I haven't seen for quite a while, and I really appreciated. Just to take you through a couple of examples of that. So, you know, they kicked off with just a really safe but good commission, which was James Graham writing a play about Fred Goodwin, who was the CEO of RBS when the financial crash happened. Great recipe for a headline show at the Edinburgh International Festival, not least because I think, Fergus, you were saying the audience in the first press night mainly was made up of people who knew Fred Goodwin personally, which is quite interesting. But then after that, I saw they had a show about censorship, particularly political censorship on stages, particularly around Gaza, which was a very kind of provocative show and was, I think, quite a brave piece to put on. You know, maybe self-congratulatory in some way that the International Festival is putting on a show about people saying that they're not putting on shows about what they're putting on a show about, but, you know, still quite interesting. They then had a show about, they then had the anniversary, 30th anniversary of Handspring's show Faustus in Africa, which was about colonialism. And they had a piece about land acknowledgements in North America, which was a very, very tense atmosphere in a play. I've never seen so many people walk out of a play. And
are we allowed to spoil it?
Yeah, why not?
Have you seen it, Aretha?
No.
It's called
You Like It, a radical retelling. But what's the trick there, Fergus?
The trick is that it's not As You Like It at all. It's that the main performer, what's his name, Cliff Cardinal. The main performer, Cliff Cardinal, comes out in front of a red curtain and begins to do a land acknowledgement, which is the kind of ritualistic acknowledgement that happens in Canada, parts of the US and Australia and New Zealand, that the work was made on the lands of the indigenous populations. And that goes on, and you think, oh, this is quite a long land acknowledgement, and it goes on, and it goes on, and then you realise, well, I realised pretty quickly, and had an inkling already, that that's all it was going to be for an hour and a half, is quite an angry man haranguing his audience about colonialism, about the inequalities that exist within Canada, about the absolutely shocking, scandalous, horrendous deaths of Indigenous kids in care in Canada. But a lot of the wealthy Edinburgh audience went along thinking they were going to see quite a traditional production of Shakespeare. And so there was a huge amount of tension and spikiness. And
the interactions with the audience were really tricky, spiky, aggressive interactions with the audience. You know, Cliff Cardinal,
you found uncomfortable? I loved it.
I found them really uncomfortable. And, you know, I don't think that feeling that discomfort is necessarily a bad thing. I think it's a really extraordinary thing that you can, you know, achieve that level of discomfort in a theatre. I don't remember the last time I felt that in a show, maybe one of Kim Noble's shows or something, where he's I won't go into what Kim Noble does on his show, so you can look up. But, you know, it's kind of an extraordinary thing. I thought it was really interesting seeing that in the context of Amazon, Gary Starr, where Gary Starr gets his audience to do ridiculous, weird things. Someone gets up naked on stage with him. Someone eats some grapes that he's already chewed up in his mouth. You know, like really strange things. But he brings you along with him so much, and he could get you to want to do or believe anything he wants. Cliff Cardinal takes the opposite approach, which is I don't have time for this anymore. I just want to tell you what I think in a very angry way. You know, that's valid. I thought it was an interesting piece of theatre. I think it didn't work in every way. I thought it wasn't brilliantly written in some ways, and his performance wasn't brilliant in some ways, but I thought the gesture of it and the anger in it were very, very powerful.
Yeah, and speak to what you're saying about the International Festival being quite bold in its programming this year. My respect for the programmers doubled when I realised what that show was going to be, because yeah. I sort of went to it thinking, like, okay, this is going to be a skit on As You Like It or something like that. I wasn't entirely sure. But then when I realised it was so provocative, I was like, brilliant. I think this is a wonderful thing to have.
And I think one of the criticisms of the International Festival programming is that they're not necessarily commissioning a lot of new stuff. So the James Graham was, I think, their only new commission this year. But I do think that they put on a really good theatre programme with no money, with very, very little money to play with.
I agree. Because this is the first year in quite a while where I've thought, actually, every show I've seen at the International Festival, even if it's premiered elsewhere, has arrested me in some way or other. The show you're just mentioning, it sounds like it was deliberately set out to prod and provoke. And that's one of the things that theatre is supposed to do. And rarely, you know, I find rare doesn't do enough these days.
Yeah.
I think the James Graham, you're right, the James Graham was, you know, this high profile commission. But it is quite a coup to get James Graham to write, to open a play. You know, this was a new play, not in London, but in Edinburgh. So I think that was a big deal. With Brian Cox. And even though he wasn't a central, he wasn't a kind of playing the main character of Goodwin, I still think that was a coup. It was a real event. You know, people travelled from London up there just to watch that play. It had a real buzz about it. And even though I wasn't completely sold on it, I just thought, yeah, this is very Edinburgh. This is very pegged into the city, to Scotland. So, and everything else I saw, as you say, Tim, it was bold. Last year, I felt everything was a little bit anodyne, and it had taken place elsewhere, and now it was here. It was part of a bigger circuit, whereas this felt carefully picked, carefully picked.
Deliberately. I didn't love Faustus in Africa, but beyond that, I think that's fair to say. And I could always do with a few less kind of international orchestras and ballets and a few more theatre shows, but that's my temperament.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a huge theatre programme, but it was a very carefully chosen one. I think that's probably a good place to end. You know, we're all still slightly recovering from another year at the Fringe, and I'm sure it will be no time at all before we start getting press releases for next year's Fringe. But thanks so much, Fergus and Arifa, for joining me, and hopefully see you here again next year.
Pleasure as always. Thank you.
Thank you, Timothy.